Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about legal issues on the show today with our two guests by phone. Mike Riley back with us. He represents clients in insurance coverage issues, mediation, and arbitration. Mike's a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. And Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Always great to be here, Larry.
With us as well, Mike, Heath Straka. He's also a lawyer in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. Specializes in personal injury actions, general litigation involving employment and construction disputes, and also complex litigation and class actions that involve product liability claims and wage and hour violations. Heath Straka, welcome.
Good morning, Larry. Nice to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. What questions, as you listen to our two attorneys, what questions do you have about employee law? Do you have homeowner or rental issues? Join the conversation. Give a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Just a reminder, we intend for today's show to give you general information, and you should not consider it as formal legal advice. Mike, let me turn to you first. I wanted to start the show by talking about some of the legal issues surrounding COVID-19. The justice system got involved in a big way when the Supreme Court, Wisconsin Supreme Court, issued a ruling on the emergency order. Can you give us the background on this? Why was the court involved and so forth?
Sure. You know, I always find it a bit curious because, you know, you don't, in the normal course of things, Larry, we've talked about our court system. Usually you'd go through, you know, the trial court and a trial judge would make a ruling one way or another, and then you'd go to the Court of Appeals. Sometimes you can bypass the Court of Appeals and go directly to the Supreme Court. But in Wisconsin, at least, you can also go directly to the Supreme Court. Our Constitution, our legislation permits that, and that's what happened here. Now, the legislature challenged the order, and they did that by going directly to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court took it up and obviously set a very short schedule. In the normal course of things, if Heath and I had something at the Supreme Court, you know, it'd be months and months and months while we briefed and, you know, rebriefed and did all those things, argued, and then there'd be usually a fairly substantial delay before they issued a decision. So here, legislature got to go directly to the Supreme Court. They set a very short briefing deadline, you know, based on the argument that the legislature made that this was doing, you know, significant harm to people's livelihoods in the state, which is an understandable argument. The Supreme Court ultimately decided that to throw this out, there were a couple things I found very interesting in the decision. I did read the primary decision. I did not read the 100 pages or so of dissents. I guess everybody had different opinions on exactly why, what should happen and why it should happen. But what the majority concluded was that this was not an order but a rule. And that seems like a kind of a strange distinction. It's one that I think for most of us we'd say, really? What, you know, what's the difference between those two? Well, the difference is with the rule, the legislature has to be involved and they have to sign off. And with an order, you know, in this case, the Secretary of Health and Social Services could have just done that on her own, which she had done. So because they concluded it was a rule, and they did that because they said, look, the language of the statute that governs this says that if it's something of general application, then it really is a rule. And I think they also were persuaded by the fact that this had the force of law, not simply saying you must do this, but saying if you don't do this, you face criminal penalties. And those two things were persuasive to the court, and those really were the foundation of their decision. The other thing that I found very interesting is the court was at pains almost immediately in its decision to say, we're not challenging the governor's order. We're just dealing with the order that was entered by the secretary, acting secretary, actually. And, you know, that was, they kept talking about the fact that she was an unelected public official. I'm not sure that makes a great deal of difference, but that seemed to be significant to the court. It does raise a question in your mind that if they really are saying, okay, we're not challenging what the governor did, could the governor then have entered the same order? And would the court then have concluded that that was valid? You know, it's and the logic of their decision, you wouldn't think so, but they really made quite a point of that in their decision. The final thing, and then I'll quit. But the final thing that I think was interesting is that they could have, one, they could have just acted with a little more restraint and held off addressing this until the end of this next order, which is the 26th, I believe, the order that was being addressed. And the Chief Justice, Justice Rogenczak, said that she would have favored waiting at least another 6 days before they implemented this. And the legislature had actually asked them to wait, you know, for about that time before they struck this down, or at least before the order from the court striking it down took effect. And for some reason, the majority declined to do that. Justice Rogenczak is the Chief Justice. It seems a little strange that she couldn't persuade the other three members of the majority to go along with that. And I guess finally, just so we've got it all out on the table, one of the things that came out, obviously, was a lot of criticism for Justice Hagedorn, who's regarded as part of the conservative majority on the court, but went in the other direction and would not have struck the order down. He immediately took a lot of flack from at least some Republican legislators and other, quotes, conservative, close quotes, commentators, apparently because he did what he believed to be the right thing and the principled thing, which I find, you know, appalling that somebody who does a justice who acts on their conscience is then going to be critiqued for doing that. So anyway, those are kind of my observations. I don't know if Heath may have some other thoughts on that.
Heath, any thoughts on that? If not, or nothing to add, have you, you've been doing a lot of speculation, or there's been a lot of speculation about liability issues around the COVID epidemic, and you can talk about that as well.
Yeah, just to follow up on what Mike was talking about, once the Supreme Court struck down Andrea Palm's and the governor's order as it relates to the Safer at Home situation, it really opened a floodgate in terms of what was going to happen, because it came out probably people were waiting for it, but counties and other municipalities then had to scramble to decide how they were going to address it. So depending on what county you're in, sometimes you have a new order like we do in Dane County. Forward Dane was implemented on May 18th, and then other counties are relying on guidance in terms of how businesses and other establishments are supposed to reopen by following what the WEDC, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, those guidelines. So depending on where you drive, where you go, you have a different set of rules. And so that kind of plays into the liability aspect of things as well.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Larry. Sorry.
No, go ahead, Michael.
Well, I just wanted to comment real briefly on that. I mean, one of the things that's interesting there is several counties immediately enacted their own rules. Some of them then pulled back, not Dane or Milwaukee, but others did, because they were concerned about the legality. The attorney general said those are different. And I think they are different. I also think that at least the legislature and probably most Republican groups who have been insisting we should do this on a local basis would not be well placed to try to challenge those orders, having said that that's the way it ought to work to begin with.
Yeah,
that's a good point, Mike. Actually, the state, when you were talking about the order versus the rule, it gets kind of down into the weeds, as Mike indicated, and that relates to a specific Wisconsin statute. That statute does not govern that same situation as it relates to what a county can do. So the counties are enacting these orders under a different statute, which provides them with more general, broad, sweeping powers in the face of an epidemic or public health situation.
Yeah, it does seem kind of strange in a way to have everybody doing their kind of their own thing, every county doing kind of their own thing. Because you can drive from one county to the next and you're under a different set of rules.
Well, especially when in some cases that might be about a 2-minute drive.
yeah, for sure. Well, there's been a lot of speculation about liability issues surrounding the epidemic. And Heath, I know you've been working on that. And businesses, I mean, are they going to have to worry about liability if an employee gets ill? Or
Well, that's you're right, Larry, and it also depends on where you are. I think the overarching theme is that if you are going to reopen, regardless of where you are, it's done responsibly and you take reasonable precautions. And if you do those things and you either follow whatever the guidance is from the county you're in or follow the guidance from the WEDC, if your county doesn't have a specific guideline, then you're probably going to be okay. Because just because something bad happens in a restaurant or an establishment or on someone's property doesn't automatically translate into a winnable personal injury or other type of case. You have to prove that the establishment owner or property owner or business owner was somehow negligent. And you could obviously come up with a fact pattern where they failed to follow any reasonable precaution and sort of threw caution into the wind. But as long as people are following whatever orders they're under or guidelines they're under, the likelihood of liability is pretty small. Coupled with that, even if you did have an issue, the causation element in a negligence claim would be pretty difficult because you would have to prove that the failure of that establishment or that business, their failure, was a substantial factor in causing that person's positive COVID test. And if that person's in one establishment, they're likely in many others and interplaying and intermixing with any number of people. So because of that, I think it would be pretty difficult to have a successful liability claim. That doesn't mean people aren't worried about it. That doesn't mean that businesses aren't contacting their insurance agents about, you know, what type of coverage they have, and that's certainly important. From a, you know, a worker standpoint, the best guidance is if you've got someone who is exhibiting symptoms or has a positive test, you should send them home. Because if you don't do that, you're not taking a reasonable precaution, and you're putting not only other coworkers at risk, but obviously any patrons that you might have.
Yeah,
let me
go ahead, Mike.
Go ahead. Well, just let me real quickly just piggyback on what Heath's absolutely right about those things. First of all, in Wisconsin, workers' compensation coverage is essentially an exclusive remedy. So in terms of your workers, and, you know, certainly you should be concerned about the workers, you should be concerned about their welfare, and as Heath said, you should be concerned about the potential for them, you know, to give the COVID to one of your customers, but the workers themselves probably can't bring a claim against their employer outside a workers' compensation context. So, you know, there's probably not any risk to the employer of having a liability claim filed against them by the worker. The second thing, and Heath made the point, and I think it's a critical point, and that is causes. Clients come in all the time, and understandably, they're focused on the fact that they were in an accident and it was somebody else's fault, or something bad happened to them and it was somebody else's fault. And that is a critical element, but you also have to prove, as Heath said, that that person caused an injury, and you have to prove that link between what they did that was wrong or what they failed to do that they should have done and the fact that you've suffered an injury. And Heath and I have both handled medical malpractice cases over our careers. And in those cases, notoriously, the problem isn't just the negligence or the liability of the medical care provider. The question is, can you prove that it would have come out differently had they done something different? And in this case, you not only have the problem of showing, as he said, that they didn't follow the precautions, and there are some fairly specific guidelines, but you'd have to show that if they had, that you wouldn't have contracted it. And as he said, there's a lot of places you can get COVID. Obviously, there's potential risks everywhere, as I think we're all too well aware now. And because of that, tying it back to that specific location, I think would be extremely difficult. And finally, let's face it, most cases are not severe. And nobody's going to want to take a case on a contingent fee basis that involves, you know, having coughing for a little bit, running a fever, maybe missing a day or two of work. You'd have to have something where this involved hospitalization and some fairly significant medical treatment or expense, potentially death. Those cases could get brought, but they are a very, very small percentage of the overall COVID cases. So all of those things would militate against this notion that there's going to be this tremendous uptick in liability claims based on the COVID virus.
Talking today with Mike Riley and Heath Straka, both attorneys, Madison attorneys with the Axley Law Firm. You can join in with your questions as we visit about the kind of the legal side of the coronavirus. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Give a call. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests, attorneys Mike Riley and Heath Straka from the Axley Law Firm in Madison, as we visit about the legal side of the coronavirus a little bit. Questions about those issues? Are you concerned about getting back to work? Want to know your options? What other legal questions do you have? Give a call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. You know, there have been a number of incidents in businesses regarding wearing or not wearing masks. There was a situation with Costco that has gotten a lot of YouTube views, for example. But can businesses legally require customers or employees to wear them?
Heath, I'm happy to both chime in, but why don't you tackle that?
Yeah, you bet. So two parts to that question, Larry. In terms of businesses requiring employees to wear them, certainly they can. I mean, the employer can mandate that their employees take particular safeguards in order to work. That's certainly within their purview to do. And I think a lot of them will do that as we go forward, especially where you're going to have person-to-person contact, whether that be in salons or tattoo parlors or even obviously in grocery stores and restaurants. I think that's you'll see that in some of the WEDC guidelines and also, you know, throughout the guidelines from a county-by-county basis. So, yeah, an employer can certainly do that. In terms of whether from the legality part of it, and whether, you know, if you're just a customer coming in, can they require you to do that? I think that's also within their purview. You know, it's kind of the no shoes, no shirt, no service
right
analogy. I mean, you can as an establishment, as a place of where the public can go and frequent, you can put certain parameters on who you serve and how you serve them. Obviously, you can't run afoul of someone's civil rights or refuse to serve them because of their race, their creed, their sex, whatever it be. But in terms of taking serious a global pandemic as we're facing and have faced for many months, I think it's pretty clear that a public place could do that.
I agree completely.
Yeah, it makes sense to me anyway. I mean, if a business can tell you not to, you've got to come wear a shirt to come in. They certainly should be able to tell you you need to wear a mask to come in. It seems like it's gotten to be kind of a political sort of thing now.
Yeah, and I think, in just to chime in a little bit further, certainly people are entitled to their view. If they don't feel that a business should be able to force them to wear a mask to come in, their recourse is, of course, to not frequent that business. So, I mean, there is recourse for the people that have a differing view, and perhaps there is a similar type store that provides the exact same type of product or service, and those people that don't agree with that business's decision, you know, have a voice. They can choose not to frequent that business.
Yeah, Larry, yeah. You and I have talked about this before. I mean, one thing, people get very fixated on their rights. And what people tend to forget is rights don't exist in a vacuum. Others have rights as well. And, you know, we start when we say life, liberty, and the pursuit. Well, life's the first one that gets listed. Yeah. And, you know, when you're engaging in an activity that creates an unreasonable risk to somebody's, you know, life or their health, then you can't simply say, well, it's my right to do that. No, it's not your right to do that. You have certain rights, but so do others. And you can't simply ignore the fact that others have rights. And your right to not have a mask on certainly doesn't override other people's rights not to have their health placed unreasonably in jeopardy.
Let's take a call. Jane in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi there. I am wondering, because I just heard a statistic this morning on NPR about the fact that 50,000 deaths could have been prevented if action had been taken even, I think it was 1 or 2 weeks sooner. And so I'm wondering, I know that your specialty isn't constitutional law, but it feels like as Americans, we're not getting the opportunity to hold people accountable as we used to be able to. So is it possible to have a class action suit against the president and his administration for their callous disregard and inaction to save human life here in this country?
Well, he's really the specialist on class actions, but my view at least would be there are so many immunities in terms of the government, and certainly the federal government. I doubt that you could bring a liability suit and ask, to be awarded damages. And frankly, I think it would be extremely difficult to get a court to do anything about that. And I couldn't agree with you more. I think the handling of this has been way past unfortunate. And as Larry said, it's been politicized, which is also unfortunate. This should not be a political issue. This is an issue of the welfare of our nation and our nation's citizens. And it's really unfortunate that, that hasn't been the focus from this administration from very early on. But Heath can speak to the class action probably with more authority than I can.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Any class action or collective action, first of all, has to have an individual case that begins it. And as Mike said, there's such broad immunities for governmental actions that to bring a case against the government for whatever failures you think they have in this situation would not get off the ground. And if you can't have an individual case, you certainly can't have a class action. So just because it has affected so many people and the numbers are so great, you still have to go back to the beginning. Is there an individual case that could have been brought in the first instance? And based on the immunity grounds and discretionary immunity that the government has and whatnot, I don't think an individual case could even get off the ground.
Legal question for our guests today, Mike Riley and Heath Straka. Give a call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Mike, you brought the issue of title lock insurance to our notice. Tell us what that is.
Well, I sort of wonder myself, Larry. I've just all of a sudden there's been this explosion of ads, on the radio and I guess on TV as well, for these outfits that are claiming that you are at grave risk because somebody is going to steal your, sign a mortgage or do something else in your name, and suddenly they're going to own your property. And that just strikes me as bizarre, frankly, because I don't think anybody can do anything. They could, I suppose, go ahead and take out a mortgage somewhere. The problem is you didn't sign up for that mortgage. You haven't signed anything. You haven't gotten the money or obligated yourself. So the notion that somebody could, they keep talking about being evicted, which isn't appropriate with a mortgage. You'd be foreclosed, not evicted. But the bottom line is I just don't see how there's any risk. Now, could something happen so you would have to deal with the situation? Yeah, it could. But the real problem would be for the financial institution or whoever else decided to grant a mortgage. You can't transfer a title that you don't hold. So if they purported to sell your property to someone else, they simply would have no right to do that. And, a court would certainly cancel that immediately. And I don't think it would ever get to a court. I mean, I think that there's just no way that I see that could really happen and could put your ownership in jeopardy. So to me, saying that you're going to sell somebody insurance for a risk that doesn't exist, other than, I suppose, arguing that, well, we'll help you, clarify this if something like this comes up. They keep talking about it as one of the fastest growing crimes. I don't know what that means, that there was one case and now there's three. I've not heard of this. I don't know if Heath has, but I've not heard of it. I know Heath dealt with an identity theft situation some years ago, which is analogous but a different thing, because with identity theft, even though you might not ultimately be responsible for a credit card or whatever, there could be quite a bit of legal hassle involved with that. And so while I'm not trying to sell that to anyone either, That, at least I understand. The title lock thing just doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know. Heath?
Yeah, I agree. I haven't heard as many of the title lock advertisements probably as you, Mike, but the way I look at it is the same as you, and I just tried to analogize it to the identity theft situation because even in those situations, there's no personal injury claim. Those cases usually come about not so much on an individual basis, but when there's been a breach by a larger entity that failed to adequately protect someone's personal and private information, social security number, dates of birth, those types of things. I dealt with a case many, many years ago on an individual basis where someone's identity was stolen, and we went through the court process, and the court ultimately ruled that you couldn't pursue that again as a quote-unquote personal injury action because the damage wasn't to your person. Your identity is more like a property interest, and when you only have a damage to a property interest, you don't have a personal injury claim. So different, as Mike said, but I thought it was a bit similar enough to discuss it.
Steve in Wausau has a question. Steve, hi.
Hey. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
I'm board of directors, and I want to call a meeting, and it's not like where I can they can't vote by mail, and a couple of them call up and say, well, we're kind of afraid of this virus. How do we know everybody's going to be clean there? We'll wear masks, and all by things happen, and one of them comes down with it and blames you for will my director's insurance cover me for that?
So you mean have them come in person, Steve?
They have to. That's the rules of the corporation.
Okay. Yeah. I don't think, Steve, first of all, clearly that's an obligation. It's an obligation that's imposed when they become a director. That's part of the obligation they assume is to attend meetings. And they have to. In this case, they have to. It's not like you have an option to say we'll do it by phone or we'll do it by mail. I don't know if you could do it by phone or by Zoom. I guess that's – but – if assuming, and you know, that it's that's sort of an interesting question. I don't know if you did it by Zoom, is that, quotes, in person? It might be, and I guess you could explore that or ask for advice on that. It would strike me that given the reality of the way we do things nowadays, you could probably argue that that is in person, that the fact that you're not sitting in the same room doesn't mean that you're not in person when you're all on the same, you know, Zoom or whatever platform you used to do that. So I guess that's part of, in terms of liability, assuming you did do that, what Heath said before is right on the mark. You need to take the proper precautions. I mean, everybody would have to mask. You'd have to, I mean, I suppose if you wanted to go to extremes, you could take people's temperatures. But I think what you'd have to do is have everybody certify that they have no reason to believe that they have, you know, COVID, that they don't have any of the symptoms. Then have everyone wear masks, distance appropriately, you know, don't have 10 people in a, you know, 6x8 room. But I think if you do those things, one, the likelihood that anybody's going to contract it, let's face it, is very limited at this point. I mean, the number of cases in our state are still very small. The chances that somebody there would have it and then would communicate it despite all those precautions are really, really small. And if that happened, I don't see that there would – I don't see, again, somebody would have to get very ill to begin to justify bringing an action. So to take all those things that are all unlikely and add them all together and say that's going to happen, is it impossible? No. Is it highly, highly unlikely? It is. If it did, if the allegation is that you were negligent as a director, I'd have to look at the policy because I don't know precisely what your policy covers. But my sense is that it likely would provide coverage for that. Certainly, you could go to whoever issues the insurance and ask that question specifically, and I'd probably recommend that you do that. But you know that I think the risk is very small.
There we go. Go ahead, Heath.
And Steve, just to piggyback on some things that Mike said, we talked a little bit about how a lot of these guidelines and how you're supposed to comport and handle your business are handled from a county-by-county basis. So I would suggest looking at Marathon County's website to see if there's some additional guidance you can find there. And if not, if there's no specific guidance, you can also look in the WEDC's website. And by doing so, you're doing exactly what Mike just said. You're taking reasonable precautions to see if you can have this in-person meeting. Whether you're required, you know, as a board of directors in a corporation to be in person is an interesting issue. The state legislator had a similar issue within the last year where a state representative wanted to be able to appear remotely because he's in a wheelchair. Initially, he was told no because they, in order to vote, they had to be in person, whether it was by committee or on the floor. But now during COVID, because of the emergent situation, obviously, not only our state legislator, but also on the federal level, they've been meeting via video. And our Supreme Court has been holding oral arguments via video. So I think if they're able to do that and bend that rule a bit, I would think that you'd be in a similar situation.
Yeah, there we go. Steve, thank you so much for calling. Ron in Beulah, Michigan, your turn. Ron, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I was curious if a person died suddenly of the virus and they did not have a will and have a grown adult children and you have a monthly mortgage on your home, then what happens to that home? Is somebody going to keep paying the mortgage, or is the bank going to take it, or what? How's that dealt with?
That's an interesting question. First of all, let me say that neither Heath nor I are specialists in that area of the law by any means. But just generally, you know, based on general knowledge, a couple of things. There is a law of intestate succession, which is just a fancy way of saying if you don't have a will, then there's rules about who gets your property. And in your case, assuming you don't have a surviving spouse, then it would go to your adult children, and it would likely, and again, I'm not familiar with Michigan law, but I don't think that's much different anywhere. Generally speaking, it would then go to your heirs, and there's orders of priority, basically. But in your case, without a spouse, it would go to the children. It would be divided equally but among your adult children. And so what would happen then, essentially, is the estate, and there would be, they'd need to create an estate, and then whoever, you know, they would have to make a decision, do we want to, you know, what's the value of the house? Is there equity in the house? Do we want to go ahead and pay the mortgage? Do we want to put the house on the market? Foreclosure would take some time, even assuming payments aren't made, and you know, so assuming somebody would reach out to the bank pretty quickly, I assume a bank or whatever financial institution is has the mortgage, and would work things out with them. But generally speaking, that's what would happen. It's always a good idea to have a will, obviously. But in that case, you know, what's going to happen likely with a will is pretty much what would happen without a will, which is your kids, unless you feel strongly about one or the other of the children, they would share equally in the estate, which would include the house.
All right. Ron, thank you for that question. Phyllis in Clark County, it's your turn. Hi, Phyllis.
Okay. I had heard that before Obama left office that he had updated the policies and procedures for nursing homes under Medicare, Medicaid to upgrade their infection control procedures and policies. And then I also read somewhere again, and I'm hoping I'm right, that President Trump said he just wasn't going to inform that upgrade in the procedures. Wouldn't that then be grounds for a group to sue the government for non-enforcement?
Yeah, I can jump in on that one, Phyllis. There certainly was a difference of opinion in terms of what protections and resources needed to be in place during the Obama administration versus the Trump administration. And, you know, in terms of what they did and how they did it, we don't need to get too far into the weeds on that. However, as we talked to about with a previous caller, to sue the government as it relates to a decision they made, a policy decision they made about how it affects anything, be it COVID or some other aspect of our lives, would be extremely difficult because the government enjoys broad immunity from civil liability. So it would be near impossible to bring a liability claim for money damages against the Trump administration or any other governmental entity for that matter as it relates to their COVID response or what they wanted to do from a policy perspective or funding or changing regulations and rules pertaining to nursing homes or any other aspect of our lives.
No, just quickly, the other thing, though, Phil, it's a good question, and unfortunately, Heath's right. I just don't think you'd be able to bring a civil action against the administration. However, this administration and, you know, Republicans generally are always talking about the costs of regulation. This is a great example of the costs of deregulation. You know, this is what can happen, and I'm not suggesting that's the sole reason or even the principal one, but part of the picture is always, okay, what do you lose when you deregulate? You know, what cost you then impose because you don't have regulation, you don't have appropriate preparation, you don't have governmental entities permitted to do their job to try to protect the people, which is what regulations are about.
And thanks again for that question, Phyllis. Appreciate it. Christina in Glenwood, it's your turn. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. My son and I, he's 40-some years old, we went to an office retail store, and we purchased a last will and testament forms kit with a CD. And I'm wondering, how legal is that?
Well, I'll take it on again, even though, and I want to make it absolutely clear, it's not my bailiwick. But generally speaking, making will is not difficult. You know, you need to follow the rules in the individual state. And I'm assuming if they gave you a kit, they would at least tell you what you need to do. You need to have it signed, witnessed by people who often have to be there when you sign it. They need to sign it at the same time. Usually has to be people who don't have an interest in the will. In other words, who are not going to benefit from the provisions of the will. So, you know, it's not rocket science. If you're not doing estate planning is a completely different thing. That is, at least from my perspective, rocket science. I mean, I don't understand that. There's a lot more that goes on there because you're thinking about tax consequences and that you can use trust. There's all sorts of things. But if all you're doing is executing a very basic will that says, this is what I want to happen to my property, you just have to make sure you follow the rules. And again, those, I would think they'd explain those in the kit. If you don't, you can go to the Wisconsin statutes. That's not complicated. You can look it up online, I'm sure, and see exactly how you need to execute the will, what the formal requirements are. But generally speaking, it's not a very complicated process.
All right. Christina, thank you so much for calling. Mike Riley and Heath Straka, our guests today, attorneys with the Axley Law Firm in Madison. I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the legal side of the coronavirus today with you. Questions about those issues? Are you worried about going back to work and want to know your options? What other legal questions do you have? Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Mike Riley and Heath Straka from the Axley Law Firm, our guests today. And we'll take another call. Christopher in Madison has something for us. Hi, Christopher. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I'm I have a house where I rent out rooms, and several of the people living in the house have been laid off and they can't pay rent. What should I do about that?
Well, Christopher, this is Heath. That's a great question, and it's certainly affecting, you know, landlords and tenants alike. Landlords are put in a difficult position where they know their tenants might not be able to make ends meet, but if a tenant's not able to pay the rent, then the landlord's not going to be able to make ends meet or pay for whatever mortgage they might have on the property. So it's certainly a big issue. Right now, there's a temporary limiting order, order number 15, that limits foreclosures and evictions. So typically, you know, if someone doesn't pay rent, there's a process you have to go through. And I don't practice in landlord and tenant law, but there's, you know, certain types of notices you have to provide before you simply evict someone or put them out on the street, as I'm sure you're aware, being a landlord. However, right now, those things are halted simply because there's so many people out of work, so many people who just can't make payments. But it's certainly doesn't only affect the tenant. It also affects the landlords who aren't receiving monies to pay, you know, to run their business.
Yeah.
One of the things I'd suggest, Christopher, and I know those are, as Heath says, those are extremely difficult situations, and particularly when you've got a longer-term tenant, you know, that somebody that you may have gotten to know a bit personally, but just, you know, you're trying to do the right thing for them. You probably can't evict them anyway right now. I'd go to the tenants and just say, look, I know this is a difficult situation. I don't know if some of them may have gotten some of the payments from the government that might be helpful. Some of the people actually on unemployment, are making more money on unemployment than they were because the unemployment payments were relatively generous in the bills that have already passed. So, I mean, I'd talk to each tenant and sort out where they really are financially. Are they really unable to pay? And if they are, they are. But, you know, maybe you could establish that to begin with. And if they really have gotten or are getting money from these programs, you may not be able to evict them, but I'd certainly say, look, you know, this is difficult for all of us, but if you're receiving income, I expect you to make at least some payment, you know, whether it's the full payment or not. And I'd also see if you can't reach an agreement that once they return to work, that there'll be a catch up and there'll be, you know, some incentive, you know, some additional payment made each month in addition to the normal rent. Because I think it's important that the tenants understand that, as Heath said, this hurts everybody. I mean, yes, it hurts the tenants, and they're in a difficult position. But again, as a landlord, you've got payments you have to make, and they need to understand that. And I think what would be important is that you reach an understanding with them that because they may not be able to be evicted, that doesn't mean they don't owe the money, because some people may have that impression that somehow they don't have to pay rent because of these orders. And that's not the case. They still owe the rent, and at some point those orders will expire, and they will be subject to eviction. So the notion that you can simply not pay rent, even though you may have the means to do so, really doesn't wash.
There you go, Christopher. Thank you very much for calling. Chuck in Menominee, it's your turn. Hi, Chuck.
Yeah, I'm curious. If you are capable of working from home and getting your job done effectively, and your employer is insisting that you be on the work site, is there any liability on the employer if you were to end up getting sick?
You know, what I'd like Heath to address, if he can, because I know that's been an issue, is there's a question about can you – it's a little different question, but their question is if your employer says, okay, I want you to come back to work, assuming, you know, that you can't work remotely, do you have – if you say, I don't want to go back because I'm concerned about COVID, can you still get unemployment? And then your question's a good one too. Can they – I doubt they would have liability, frankly, although, you know, again, Heath can address that, but I don't know that they'd have liability. The question is, I guess, can they insist that you come back, even though there may be a risk in doing that, and you can work effectively from home? So with having created all those problems, Heath, I'll turn it over to you.
I appreciate it. One of the big issues right now facing lawyers in this realm, Chuck, is it's hard to give specific guidance because all of this is new every day. There's new guidelines, there's new rules, there's new orders every day, and we all try to keep up with it as fast as we can to give the best advice that we can. In no particular order, as it relates to liability, if your employer, you know, quote unquote, forces you to come back even though you don't want to, that liability there would be difficult from a civil perspective. There may be an issue if you contract COVID. There could be a workers' comp claim, and Mike talked about that in responding to a previous caller. And the DWD does have, Department of Workforce Development does have, they sort of define injuries and from a finger to a toe to whatnot. And a respiratory illness is something that can be covered under a workers' comp claim. So you can't be denied just because it's a respiratory illness as long as you can otherwise prove that it was related to your employment. In terms of whether the employer can force you to come or not, that involves a lot of different issues because it's going to depend in part how big the employer is, what rules they fall under from federal law versus state law. There's the FMLA that would come into play, and on top of that, the other issue is if these employers have accepted money from the government through these temporary loans to keep their businesses afloat, that triggers other duties on the employer than they otherwise wouldn't have in order to treat their employees a little bit differently than they normally may have to because of the COVID situation. But if someone is not exhibiting symptoms and does not have to stay home to care for someone who is inflicted with COVID, be it a spouse, a child, or another loved one that they have to care for, even though they can effectively work from home, just being afraid of exposure wouldn't be enough for you to be able to say, yeah, I have to stay at home.
Ah, there we go. Chuck, thank you for that question. Dan in Racine, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Quick question. If you would happen, God forbid, lose somebody to COVID and they're in the hospital and with the quarantine ways they are right now, and you didn't know if they had a will, is there a way to find out if they had a will?
Well, some wills are filed with the county where the will is executed, and you could check to see, and I believe that's still the case. Again, probate wills really aren't my field, but you could certainly check with that. Otherwise, obviously, if you know who the attorney is or who the attorney was that would likely have had them execute the will, drafted the will, you could check with the law office, but I can't believe you couldn't. I mean, even assuming you can't visit somebody, you should be able to at least call them in the hospital. I mean, if they're on a ventilator, I suspect you can't. But I mean, I don't know if they have a cell phone, but barring that, they certainly would have access to a phone within the hospital, I would assume, and you could give them a call and ask them the question. I understand that's not necessarily the easiest question to ask somebody at that stage is, oh, incidentally, do you have a will? But, I would certainly reach out to them. And I mean, if they didn't, I would assume that there certainly are ways. I mean, there is staff that could witness a will. You could have it drafted and then have it given to staff. They could give it to the person to execute. I would think some of these visitation rules either have been relaxed already or will be because, frankly, that's one that I was not a fan of where you're telling people if somebody's dying, you can't go visit them. I thought with proper precautions that made very little sense to me, honestly. But that in terms of the will, I think you should be able to reach out to them. I can't believe you can't have contact in some form, whether it's a text or, a phone call or whatever, and get that information. And then if they haven't a will and need one, they could, they could call you, tell you what they want in the will, or they could, you could arrange to have an attorney talk to them and be told what they want in the will and simply get that done.
There we go.
And just to follow up on what Mike said, it's probably there's no easy answer to that. But what it always reminds us when you're in these situations that you don't plan for is to have your estate planned well, to have a will, to have a durable power of attorney, a power of attorney for health care, financial decisions ahead of time so that when you are put in a situation that you didn't expect, your loved ones know what to do.
Yeah, that's great advice.
Thank you, Dan, for that question. Rusty in Stevens Point, hello.
Hello, thank you. Being a small business owner, just looking for a little clarity regarding the rules or guidelines that are being put in place by, say, per county, per state, whatever. When it says a guideline, how closely does that have to be followed, or can you be... being a small business, if I didn't make my employees wear a mask or require customers to wear a mask or something on that order, what are my rights regarding that? Is that just a guideline to follow, or is it something that I can be fined or penalized for? I'm curious on that.
Well, the state order was struck down, so you don't have any exposure there, and that did, you know, that did have criminal penalties, but that's no longer operative. So you don't have to worry about that. Most, I don't, you'd have to look at your county. I'd be a little surprised if, in Stephen's point, if they actually had adopted something local. But if, you know, it's best to know that and just go on. They must have a website for the county or the city of Stephen's Point and just look to see what the requirements are. The difference is pretty clear, though. A guideline is a guideline. It doesn't subject you to penalties. Nobody can come in and arrest you or fine you or do anything else for not following a guideline, unless there's a specific rule in place that says that's what's going to happen. And it's still, I think there might be some real question about, you know, how enforceable that is. And I think there's an even larger question about how interested most counties and or cities are in enforcing these things. Barring somebody really just flagrantly flouting, violating the rules. The significance to me of a guideline in this situation is this, and Heath talked about it before. If you follow guidelines, it would be a very strong argument in terms of saying, I don't have any liability for this. I didn't do anything wrong. I followed the guidelines. If you fail to follow the guidelines, does that mean you're automatically liable? No, you still have all the hoops you have to jump through that we talked about before. But what happens in lawsuits, one of the things lawyers do look for if you're suing for liability is you look and say, is there a guideline? Whether it's a product or it's, you know, running a business in a certain fashion, are there safety guidelines in effect there? Because if there are safety guidelines and they're not followed, then at least gives you some basis to say, look, that's the standard of care. That's what you're supposed to do to exercise ordinary care, which is what the law requires in a civil action. And if given the fact that you followed the guidelines, it's going to be a plus. If you don't follow the guidelines, it's probably a minus. Does it mean you're going to be liable? No, that in itself doesn't mean that. But it could potentially create a higher risk of being found liable.
There we go. Thank you so much for that question. Mike Riley and Heath Straka, attorneys with the Axley Law Firm, our guests. They'll be with us up till 12:30 today. I'll take a quick look now at the news and weather, and then we will be back with them. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at legal topics today on the show, getting some advice on issues surrounding COVID-19. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us. Mike Riley back with us, Madison attorney and a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm. With him, Heath Straka. He practices at the Axley Law Firm as well and focuses on personal injury actions and general litigation involving employment and construction disputes. So what do you want to know about liability during these times? What other legal questions do you have? Join in. Give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And guys, Mike in La Crosse emailed to say he works in healthcare and his employer has a policy that he cannot have a second job. Mike doesn't see this as legally enforceable, but also realizes Wisconsin is an at-will employment state. What are your thoughts on that?
No, that's definitely Heath's bailiwick.
Yeah, all right. I can speak to that, Larry and Mike. That's a good question. You're right. Wisconsin employers can put basically whatever restrictions they want on your employment to a certain degree. Restrictive covenants and covenants not to compete are routinely seen in higher-end jobs, and typically in Wisconsin those can be struck down because the argument is that you want to have a free-moving society and you don't want to restrict trade. As it relates to this particular situation, I'd be curious to know if this was put in place specifically because of COVID. And so since Mike is working in healthcare and his healthcare employer doesn't want him to be working in a second job where he might be exposed to more people, or have, or though they can't guarantee that that employer is taking the reasonable precautions that they should, I think that it would be sufficiently linked to his employment that they'd be able to do that, and it would make sense. If it was put in place before COVID, that would potentially be a restriction of his trade and potentially an issue.
Yeah. I suppose the employer could say, well, it was put in place beforehand, but now we want it to apply because of COVID. Could they get away with that?
Well, that would be a little bit difficult because you have a pretext argument. So you can't put in a rule for one reason and then change it because something else has come up. And that happens a lot in the employment context. So that in and of itself would not be a winning argument.
Okay.
And as Mike pointed out and Heath pointed out too, we are an at-will employment state, which does make it difficult. And, you know, there's always a practical aspect to this. I mean, Heath and I, well, Heath can give legal advice on those issues. I wouldn't presume to. But, you know, one of the practical issues is, okay, you get fired and then you challenge that and you can jump through a bunch of hoops, but your life gets pretty complicated. And, you know, you really do have to decide, is that a fight I want to have? You know, is it worth having that fight? And I suppose there's another question. How do they even know you have a second job? I mean, there's a lot that goes on practically in addition to, you know, the potential legal issues.
Let's take a call. Courtney in Appleton, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I really like your show.
Thank you.
Thanks. I had a question about caps on the amount of hours that can be enforced for salaried workers to perform during a week. So I'm a salaried worker. I am scheduled approximately 50 hours per week, but with everything going on, we are, you know, working upwards of 60 to, you know, 70 hours per week, which isn't very good for work-life balance. And we also may or may not be being compensated for that. So I guess I'm wondering advice on that.
Well, Courtney, that is a very good question, and it sounds like you're being worked to death almost. I mean, those are a lot of hours for regardless of the type of job that you're holding. There's no per se rule against the number of hours that an employer can have you work. However, they have to compensate you for your hours. They have to, if you're working over 40 hours in a week, you have to be paid time and a half at your regular rate of pay. And in terms of the number of hours and the rate of pay, that always has to be above the minimum wage threshold in Wisconsin. So if they're paying you, but when you break it down to the hourly rate, if that falls below that minimum threshold, then you have a potential wage and hour claim. If they're not paying you for properly for overtime or properly calculating your overtime, you also have a potential wage and hour claim. So, you know, just because they're forcing you to work more hours doesn't in and of itself provide you a claim. But if they're not properly paying you for that additional work, there could be a situation there where you may have a wage and hour claim.
Yeah.
Keith, I think she said she was salaried. How do you determine do you still get paid for hours above 40?
Yeah, so it doesn't matter that's your salary. Now, you don't have to. It depends on the job, and there's the high earner exceptions, and there's a variety of different exceptions that may apply. But if you are salaried and they're forcing you to work so many hours that your effective hourly rate falls below the minimum wage in Wisconsin, you have a wage and hour claim whether you're salaried or not. If you're an exempt employee because you're managerial or you have the authority to hire, fire, discipline people, that opens up a whole nother can of worms. But if you're a salaried employee and you're not exempt, they still have to pay you above minimum wage once you break down what your salary is to an hourly wage.
Courtney, does that help?
It does. So I think I would fall within the exempt employee status, so I would have to look more into that. But thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And some more callers coming online, but homeowners, we had another question relating to insurance coverage. If you're a homeowner, what do you need, and is the same for condo owners?
Yeah, that's something I propose, Larry, and because I've handled a number of those cases. I think Keith has as well, but let me start at least. One, if you're a condo owner, and I'll take that first just because it's more complicated, you need to be sure you know what your condo policy is. Your condo association will have a policy. Normally, that covers the exterior or the structure itself. I mean, obviously, the roof. It's not like it's just once you get past the outer wall, it's nothing. But, I mean, if your house burns down, an awful lot of that's going to be covered by your condo association. That's the structure. And so you need to know, it's really important to look at that policy and see what it covers and see what kind of protection it provides. Then, you also need to have a condo owner's policy, one that has to cover your personal property, and you need to be sure that's adequate. And that is true as well with homeowners. If you think about what you own, none of us do that on a regular basis. We don't go and, count the rugs or count the pictures or the couches or anything. And, I think if you ask the average person, they would underestimate what it would cost to replace the contents of their home or condo by 50% at least. It really gets expensive. When you think of things, particularly things you may have bought 10 years ago for a whole lot less than they are now. And we just have so many things in our life now with computers and speakers and all these things. And it's really important to go through, do an inventory. I don't mean you have to list everything. It's a great idea to photo things, take a video or a photo of the interior so you can, if you have a loss, it's, again, very hard to remember. If your house burns down, trying to remember everything that you had in that house is not easy. And a photo or a video that you keep somewhere off-site is a very good idea. But, again, make sure that the limits are adequate. With homeowners, you normally get half the value of the structure. Is usually what, your personal property limits are. But again, that may be adequate. It may not. You need to make sure you know, and you should discuss that with your insurance agent. Same thing with replacement value for us. You need to be sure you know what it's really going to cost to rebuild your home. If you're talking about a condo, you need to know what am I going to, I'm going to need to, replace the floors, certainly. It's not just, the exterior walls, they'll do that. But things you have to know, are they going to replace the floors? Are they going to replace floor coverings? The likelihood is they may not. So you need to be sure that you have that stuff covered, under your own condo owner's policy. And then finally, just because I see this come up as well, having renter's insurance is really important. Again, a lot of us have kids away at college. We often pay for the renter's insurance for them if there's going to be any. And that raises a couple issues. One, again, kids have a lot of stuff, a lot more than I had, I think, back then. And you need to make sure that there's adequate coverage to replace that stuff because you tend to think a few $1,000 will do it, and it almost certainly won't. I mean, it could be 10, 20, 25, 50, it can be a lot of money. And you also need that liability coverage because as an apartment renter, and for that matter, a condo owner and a homeowner, there's a liability aspect to each of those policies that provides you coverage. If somebody is injured on your property and brings a lawsuit, then that's what that coverage is for. And you should make sure that coverage is adequate. $10,000 is not adequate. You need to have, usually with homeowners, it's a minimum of $100. And in my view, that's not enough either. I mean, you should have much more than that given the cost of medical bills. We've discussed that before. But the other thing with a renter's insurance, what I've seen happen on several cases now is parents sign on the lease to guarantee the lease. And in part of that, if the kid starts a fire and, ends up damaging the premises, the kid may get sued and the parent may be in a position where based on having signed a document, they may get sued for the damage that's been done. So it's really important to be sure that you've got appropriate coverage as a renter, as a condo owner, as a homeowner. And we all, lawyers included, tend to take that too much for granted. Look at your policy, see what you've got, make sure it's adequate.
Let's take another question from Mitch in Dodgeville this time. Hi, Mitch. Thank you for calling.
Hey, guys. It's been a great show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I got a question regarding employment law. I'm currently working for a major company that has to support the telecommunication services around the state. We've had a third shift in place for a number of years. They've recently decided to eliminate it. So they're asking all of us that we're working days to start rotating into nights the same day that we work days. So the example is you'd come in, work 8 to 5, and then they ask you to come back in and work 10 o'clock at night till 6 or 8 in the morning. It's presenting itself with a serious drowsy driving situation. I believe as I read some of the laws on drowsy driving, the impairment is going to fall on me if I get a ticket for it. Is that right?
Well, Mitch, this is that's a very interesting set of facts, and being forced to go back on the road, if that's what you're typically doing a few hours after you just completed a long shift, is problematic. I mean, you may have some personal liability if you didn't properly rest and those things, but if an employer is forcing you to be back out on the road, and they reasonably should know that you could end up drowsy driving, as you put it, there could be potential liability there if you end up hurting someone. They can certainly have you work certain hours. They've got to pay you for all the hours that you perform work for them. But in terms of the liability aspect of it, as you were talking about, if you did injure someone and it was because and directly related to the fact that you were drowsy because of excess hours of work, there would be potential liability on your employer for forcing you to do that.
Yeah, I agree completely with Heath. I mean, I guess the question is, are you driving their vehicle or your own vehicle? And really not just are we talking about going to and from work, or are you talking about drowsy driving while you're performing work?
I am driving their vehicle. Sites scattered around the state that require maintenance in the overnight hours, but they have chosen to get rid of their third shift and put us all into this situation, or at least all of us in the Madison Metro, Southern Wisconsin area, into this situation. Without going into details anymore of identifying the company, I believe it's ridiculous. But it seems like they're attempting to get rid of staff to convert more people to salary rather than hourly staff that have been supporting them for a long period of time.
Well, and Heath had pointed out earlier that, you know, that obviously if you're hourly, then they've got to meet all the wage and hour issues. And if you're over 40 hours, pay you, you know, Heath discussed that earlier. So that's one part of it. But I will say this. If you are driving their vehicle, their insurance company is primarily responsible. So if you're in an accident, they're going to be responsible. And the fact that they caused you to drive and when you might not have been, you know, as sharp as you should have been, certainly would be part of it. I mean, obviously the accident facts are going to be the accident facts, but if you do something that's negligent and part of that is the fact that the company had you driving, they certainly are going to be liable. But the fact is, if you're driving their vehicle, they're going to be liable anyway. So from their standpoint, you'd think they wouldn't want to do that because they're creating a real risk of liability for themselves and, of course, really for their insurance company. And I'm sure the insurance company absolutely wouldn't want them to be doing that.
There you go, Mitch. Thank you very much for calling. And David in Sparta, it's your turn. Hi, David.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I wanted to expand on something from another caller. The salary issue, whether you're salary or hourly, a lot of it depends on your specific contract. So when you sign that salary contract, if it doesn't state a specific number of hours, then it's assumed 40 hours a week. If it does state a specific number of hours, then that's broken down to figure out what your hourly wage is based on that number of hours per week throughout the year. So if you say your contract says 50 hours and you work 60 hours this week, they do still have to pay you overtime or premium time for those extra 10 hours for that week. Now, that can be based on extrapolated over the month, or it can be over the 2 weeks, depending on how often you're paid. But within that pay period is what they actually look at for hourly wages and overtime.
Yeah, and David, you're not wrong. One of the previous callers inquired about a non-contractual employment, and the vast majority of workers throughout Wisconsin don't have an employment contract. We're all employment at will. But you're right, there are ways that you have to calculate the effective hourly rate, and whether you have a set number of hours in a contract or you're working a number of hours, they still have to pay you the overtime premium if you go over that. So you're raising a very good point, and it's a little bit of a different question than what was asked before, but you're absolutely right in certain respects.
Yeah. David, thank you very much. Patrick in Amherst Junction, hello to you.
Thank you. I have a question about durable power of attorney. I am a power of attorney for an aunt who is 94, and at that time she was living in Albuquerque, New Mexico. She has since moved to the Twin Cities in an assisted living care, and she has a number of savings bonds that are coming due that have to be signed in front of a financial officer, but the assisted living facility that she's in are not letting the people out to go out because of the COVID scare, which I totally get. But so can I still sign for power of attorney even though she now resides in Minnesota?
Well, and again, the major caveat there, because this isn't the work that either Pete or I do, I'm generally familiar with powers of attorney, durable powers of attorney. What you really need to do is look at the power of attorney. Most of those are very broad in general and permit you to do pretty much anything. And that's the question. I mean, if it gives you those very broad powers to make financial decisions, to execute financial documents, then I don't think the fact that she moved from New Mexico likely makes a difference. I think that power of attorney should be effective. But again, I'd be much more comfortable having you talk to an attorney who actually does that work. Do this. If you look us up online, look for Axley, okay, AXLEY, and just send an email. If you send me an email or a text, send it directly to me. I'll talk to somebody in the firm and get you a better answer. I'll get an answer from somebody who actually does that work. I think you're fine to do it, again, assuming that the document gives you those powers.
All right. Patrick, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Wow, lots of things covered today. In the last minute and a half we've got, any final things you want to comment on, Mike?
No, I think that, I appreciate all the calls, and as usual, they're great callers. This situation is terrifying, and, people just need to be careful. At the end of the day, as we've said several times during the show, there's a legal answer and there's a practical answer. And the practical answer to this is be careful, take care of yourself, take care of others. It's fairly clear that our administration federally isn't going to take care of us. We need to take care of one another.
And Heath?
I appreciate the opportunity to be on today, Larry and Mike, so thank you. We did have a lot of interesting calls, and I hope we were able to give some good answers to some really good questions. But it's the overarching theme in all of our answers was for people to act reasonably. And I think as long as we all act reasonably and like as Mike said, take care of one another, this too shall pass. But if we're reckless and we put ourselves in positions where we're not following guidelines, we're not following whatever county orders that are in place, you're going to put yourself at risk not only for liability, which were a lot of the questions, but at risk for your own health.
Well, guys, thank you so much. I hope we have a chance to do this again. Mike and Heath, we'll look forward to another visit down the road. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Larry. Enjoyed it.
Mike Riley, Madison attorney. Heath Straka, also a Madison attorney. They both work for the Axley Law Firm in Madison. Great to have them with us. And I'm sure we'll be talking about legal issues down the road in one form or another. Looking ahead, tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll talk about growing community through gardening. That's at 11 o'clock and Saturday morning at 6 and online anytime. Have you checked out our blog yet or lately? We have a new entry about the International Crane Foundation's new visitor center. Just go to wpr.org/Larry to see and check it all out. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.